Welcome to Mysterious Universe Plus, Season 10, Episode 22. Coming up on this show, we've got criminal mind control, the heart controlling the brain, and being tempted by the Skinwalker's gold. I'm Benjamin Grundy. Joining me is professional pirate treasure hunter Aaron Wright.
I'm not really a professional. I only do it occasionally now. You know, like, I've kind of given that up. You know what? I'm actually incredibly, incredibly depressed tonight, Ben.
Come on.
There's
a show to record. Lighten up.
I'm excited about the show, but I'm actually really depressed. First of all,
why?
I just found out that Grumpy Cat's owner made $120 million.
Why does that surprise you?
$120 million. Because I live on a planet where someone can take a photograph of their shitty cat and make $120 million.
Because the movie's coming out too.
So
he's got movie deals, website deals.
I know.
In constant interviews.
And on top of that, on the weekend, I think I actually got myself into a state of hysteria. I finally have experienced the social hysteria that is the booms that are going, the YOLO swag booms.
Hashtag booms.
That we were talking about. So on Saturday night, you send me this message saying, I can hear the booms. I'm like, oh, come on, whatever. You're like, go outside. I go outside. I can hear them.
Yeah, they were there.
I could hear these booms. I'm like, what the hell is that? Turns out, because it's been overcast, we've just had 7 days of thunderstorms, that there's been fireworks probably about 10 kilometres away from us, and it was travelling through the clouds.
But I also like it.
I was like, oh.
That we've had 7 days of thunderstorms. Like, that doesn't coincide with people hearing booms in Sydney.
Yeah, exactly. But I mean, it has been an unusual weather phenomenon. I don't think we've ever had 7 days of thunderstorms. There was a report on a local media channel here saying that this is unprecedented. You don't have these sort of storms. And, you know, my kitchen flooded. It's flooded twice now. Like, it's just been crazy. But in saying that, I'm now beginning to think that these booms that have been reported everywhere aren't actually a result of something weird happening. It probably is a little bit of Twitter hysteria.
Well, Twitter hysteria, and in our case, I'm sure it was thunder.
Oh, yeah. Well, that's
it
a possibility as well.
Thunder.
Yeah, exactly.
But for a small, brief moment, you know, it was like, great, the apocalypse has started.
I know.
Awesome.
I was really excited. I'm like, oh, my God, maybe there's going to be a massive earthquake somewhere soon. I'm like, wait a minute, why am I excited about that?
Why does someone else having a successful cat empire
while we're back here again
make you depressed? It's like, why does that upset you? You should be happy that a guy out there has
a girl.
A weird
she was a
cat.
Waiter. Good on her. No, I'm not worried about that. Good on her.
I know. It's the other one that has a male owner. Who's the Bubs?
What the hell is Bubs?
You haven't seen Bubs?
No, I haven't seen Bubs. I don't give Bubs more money.
The other weird looking cat.
Really? That's the thing. How can weird looking cats generate? I mean, Madonna is only worth $500 million or something. I mean, how is it that someone could be worth $120 million? Anyway, I'm going to move on.
We're doing it all wrong. Our business model is completely backwards. We need to go to the shelter and find a slightly bunted animal and then just start, you know, marketing it.
That is a brilliant business model. That is what my future is going
to be. What's another thing? Next cat, like, what can we have it? Like, no, Grumpy Cat's taken. Bubs is taken.
I've got a dog with anxiety problems. So,
What about Pessimist Dog?
Yeah, that could work.
You know, something like that. Like Racist Turtle. Let's get Racist Turtle.
Why not? Yeah, they got to go towards one type of person.
First up in the news, we have this crazy headline from the New Zealand Herald, although this is a story coming from London. Brazen thief hypnotises shop owner before dipping into pockets.
Is that the headline?
Incredible CCTV footage has emerged that shows a thief steal from a bottle shop in North London after appearing to hypnotise the shop's owner. The video shows the unidentified thief put the owner of the Hop and Pops shop in Highgate into a trance-like state before rummaging through his pockets and stealing hundreds of pounds. Entering the shop, and there's a video here, we'll link to the YouTube video in the show notes, we see the man who is said to be of Eastern European descent, aka a gypsy.
Oh, wow. But okay, keep going.
Begin to talk to the shop owner, Hader, and place an arm on his shoulder. After motioning a stabbing action towards the man's face, the shop owner is left dazed and motionless. And yeah, watching the video, this is where he distracts the guy, slips his hands into his jacket, and takes the takings, which is a huge wad of cash. The offender then just waves goodbye and walks out.
Yeah.
And there's this brief period of just a few moments where the shop owner is kind of confused and then realizes he's been robbed, charges outside, but the guy's gone.
Well, he appears to be standing there in some sort of stupor just for a couple of seconds, and then you can tell that he has recovered, that there is something that he's realised has gone wrong, and he does go running out. But I think hypnotism is the wrong way to describe what's going on here, and I'll explain that in a moment. But Mindhacks actually posted a number of articles relating to this concept of hypnotism, mesmerism, and crime, and how for a very long time, since the 1800s, there has been this weird link in our culture about hypnotism being able to control people to get them to do what you want, and evil people utilizing it so that they can commit horrible acts of just egregious crimes.
On the sex book we read on the Last Plus extension, they had a chapter on mesmerism.
Oh, did so they really?
I was going through that, and how it was in the 1800s as well, when it got really popular. There was descriptions of how these mesmerism masters would use heavy breathing to essentially hypnotize their female victims.
Really?
They would literally breathe on them. They'll be like, whew.
And that would cause them to go into a love stupor of some kind. See, what's happened here is that they've linked from Mindhacks to this innovative biomedical center called the Wellcome Collection. And they've created this amazing, fascinating story of mesmerism. And the website is just beautiful. I'll link to it so you can check it out yourself.
Well, you scroll down and it kind of tells the story as you're scrolling down the page.
Yeah, and it goes from the beginnings of animal magnetism and how there was a scientist or a doctor who believed that there was this energy that we can't necessarily see. But it allows this healing to occur, but also hypnotism and control. Then later on, you have James Tilly Matthews, who was a tea magnate. Like, he would obviously move tea around. But he was one of the first people who was committed to an insane asylum because he was diagnosed, well, we didn't realize at the time, but as being a paranoid schizophrenic.
Right.
But he was believing, just when electricity was coming into vogue and people were beginning to understand it, that there was a group, a gang of people that had constructed a machine called an heirloom. And this machine was hidden in underneath London, and it was being utilized to transmit electricity and controlling mesmerism and hypnosis to get people to do things. And he was believing that they had different modes that were able to be utilized by this heirloom.
It's awesome that even in the 1800s, you had Illuminati mind control conspiracies.
Oh, this guy was ATS forums. This guy was above top secret back in the 1800s.
Nothing's changed. Now people would say, oh, HARP's, you know, controlling everyone's minds.
Yeah, so there's HARP. There's also these ideas of, you know, psychotronic weapons and that sort of stuff. And that will come up in a moment as well. But at the time, he believed that there was a mode that they could switch the heirloom to, which was called the lobster cracker mode. And it was, he believed that you could actually send so much information and hypnotic suggestion into someone's mind that you could cause them to crack like a lobster.
Oh, wow.
So, I mean, obviously he was completely out of his tree, but, you know, there were some people that followed him. And even up until, you know, the late last 100 years or so, people still believed that there was a possibility that there was this machine, that electricity was part of it, and it could be used to manipulate and control people. And you're right, that has continued until today. But then, of course, we then move into some of the negativities around hypnotism in crimes in itself. And there's been a couple of cases. There was one in the late 1800s where a woman by the name of Gabrielle Bompard in 1889 was found guilty of murdering a man. But beforehand, see, this guy was a notary public, and the murderer who was actually involved had committed the murder, but she was someone who was there at the scene as well and was alleged to have participated. But she claimed that the actual murderer had hypnotized her and controlled her to commit this actual murder.
Well, that's right. And that started this huge debate over whether it was actually possible to hypnotize someone to kill someone against their will.
Exactly. And it was this big thing back in France at the time. And they had all of these different psychiatrists come in, and it was this big debate. And eventually it came out that's like, well, no, I'm sorry, you can't be hypnotized to commit a murder. And she was found guilty and she spent 21 years in prison. So, I mean, obviously, there are these, you know, these ideas back then, but they've persisted. Back in 1927, there was a German woman who claims that she was just simply sitting on a train carriage one day and a man came aboard the train. When he came aboard the train, he then utilized these methods of hypnosis, which it doesn't suggest how he did it, but he then convinced her to become his sex slave for a period of several months. And there was a lot of contention about that as well, because obviously there's the connotations of rape, which is horrible, and all those sort of things. But also it was like, well,
maybe he used powdered vegetables.
Oh, God. Well, let's not go down that path. But there was suggestion that, well, hang on, if this is actually occurring, how is it that you keep on going back? Is the hypnotic suggestion there? But in modern times, we now know that you can't hypnotize someone against their own will. You can't make someone do something that they don't want to do. And if anyone suggests something that goes against your values or your moral belief system, or is any way dangerous to yourself or anyone else, your subconscious will actually reject it. And that's why hypnosis itself, when you get those hypnosis tapes off iTunes because you want to study harder or you want to make sure that you train at the gym more or cure depression or anything else like that, you actually have to listen to them for 21 days to even get them to cross into that part of your brain.
Yeah, and I was going to push back a little bit on that idea and say, well, if you look into some of the experiments done by the CIA, for example, it would suggest otherwise, that perhaps you can force people to do things against their will. But these are some pretty hairy experiments that took place. You know, the subjects experienced horrible things that went on for weeks and weeks and weeks, perhaps years.
Exactly. Well, let's add that to it. So not only did it go on for an extended period of time, so you can't just walk up to someone in the street and then, you know, wave a watch back and forward.
It's more like brainwashing rather than hypnotizing someone on the spot.
Well, often with the CIA as well, whatever they were doing with MKUltra and those very, very dark projects back then, there was also drugs involved. There was LSD, there was sodium pentothal, there was some type of ongoing influence, which, yes, I mean, there is a possibility where you can change people. But there's also been, like, let's just go through some of the history there. I picked this up from a website which just details a few crimes that have been suggested to have been induced by hypnosis. There was a woman who was a bank teller and she was sitting behind the till, and a man of Indian appearance, which suggests that there's actually, these are folk tales which are more racist.
Yeah, right.
But a man of Indian appearance walked up to the teller. He waved his hand across, basically like a Jedi mind trick, and then she handed over the money and came out of the stupor and realized that she'd just given away the money and she lost her job because she had been hypnotized.
Well, that's an identical story to the famous Russian psychic who wanted to convince Stalin of his powers and went and robbed one of the banks using that same technique.
Yes, exactly. So we now know that it's almost impossible for someone to actually be able to do that, but there might be something behind it. It may not actually be hypnotism at all, but there may be groups of people that have an understanding of how to confuse the mind.
If you think it's gypsies, man, just say gypsies.
Okay, well, look, I'm not going to go that far, but look, okay, it is gypsies. Okay, okay, so let's go to the Seattle Times now. And this is actually reported by Kim Murphy from the Los Angeles Times, but she's reporting from Moscow. And there was this alleged incident where a woman says he was striking. He had these dark eyes, a long black ponytail and a stylish suit. He had a large, cheap ring that she couldn't stop looking at. And Olga, who is the woman who apparently is the victim in this case, said he kept on waving his hand repeatedly in front of her face. Yeah. And he was talking gibberish, but she was obsessed by the ring. She was noticing it. And the man convinced her that he had no money and he needed to borrow some money from her. And she said, oh, well, I'll give you 250 rubles. And he said, no, and waved his hand again and said, I need more. And so she gave him 500. He said, can I have more? And then he kept waving the hand. Eventually gets to the point, according to this story, where he confuses her out of 7,000 rubles, which I don't know how much money that is, but let's, you know, it's probably $1,000 or so. But then she realizes afterwards, after he departs, that she's been hypnotized, or so claimed, and reports it to the police. Now, this article says that in Russia itself, their federal police agency have up to 400 to 500 reports every year of something called gypsy hypnosis. It's actually referred to as gypsy hypnosis. And look, let's like try to get past the racial implications here, because this is actually quite horrible. Even in 2001, President Vladimir Putin signed a law making it illegal to employ electromagnetic infrasound radiators or other weapons that have psychotronic influence, because people were claiming that the gypsies were using these weapons.
It's unbelievable how backwards Russia still is in so many areas.
It's well, you know what? I thought about it, and it is so backwards, but I also thought maybe if the Russians had been experimenting with these weapons, as we know that they have been, maybe that's why the government was like, well, we mess with them. Maybe the gypsies did get hold of them and are using them. But it's not about gypsies. It's just about the fact that there are some fraudsters out there. They're not necessarily part of any ethnic group. There are just people in Russia that have actually been able to make control of this ability to confuse the mind.
You see, I think the biggest problem comes in with the terminology, because when you think of hypnotism, it's about putting someone in an altered state of consciousness.
Yes.
But in the cases where this is described as gypsy hypnotism in Russia, and even if we go back to the first story from the UK, they're clearly using diversion tactics. They're confusing their victim. They're trying to overload their brain with information so that they're essentially distracted while they do their thievery.
Exactly. Overload is a really good term to describe what's going on here. And in fact, a retired Russian investigator, and he used to be a scientific researcher with the Institute of Federal Police, said that it's not hypnotism here. It's not gypsies. It's a group of people that utilize a technique, which is form replacing content. And what he means by that is, he says, our brain is built so it can process only so much information over a certain period of time. In cases where the flow of information is either too powerful and fast, or on the other hand, too slow, the brain slows down and the person's level of vigilance drops. So by distracting someone with these skills, you are able to rob them. And that seems what has happened in this video. But you found some details about, is it Darren Brown?
Yeah, well, Darren Brown, the UK illusionist, he's demonstrated this time and time again. There's a pretty popular YouTube video where he goes to a train station in London and just robs a guy blind. Like, robs and returns his phone about five times during the video, but he describes how he's doing it. Let's take a listen.
I keep him slightly bewildered with a series of instructions and questions which renders him very suggestible. I use a kind of tactile misdirection. I attract his attention to one wrist by holding in there quite firmly while I remove his watch from the other. Opening his jacket to suggest a lapel mic hides his view as I quickly check his trouser pockets. And my right arm then hides his view as my left hand enters his inside pocket. I do give this all back.
So by the end of the video, I mean, the guy starts off wearing a suit and tie. And by the end of the video, he's lost.
Why am I naked?
He's lost his tie, he's lost his pen, he's lost his wallet, he's lost his phone. And yeah, he looks down at his shirt, he's like, I swear I was wearing a tie this morning.
It goes to show you, though, and I think this is exactly what is happening, our brains can only process so much at a particular time, and we do get distracted by things. It is so easy. Like, the fact is, like, I have a watch on my wrist. I know that watch is there. Yeah. But then somehow, it's true. I mean, if someone distracts you enough, they would be able to remove it without you even realizing, because your body adapts to sensations. So remember when, like, I don't wear a watch anymore at all, but when I first started wearing a watch, I used to like, oh, yeah, you know, this isn't that good. But you finally get used to it. So your body adapts to the situations that you're in. And it's exactly the same thing that he's doing here. He's allowing the body to become confused so it can't adapt fast enough, and then he's able to rob the person. So there's no hypnotism involved at all.
What kind of bothers me about these kind of tricks, and I think this is where this thief in the UK got the idea, is you can go to Amazon or the Kindle, you know, bookstore, and you can search for mind power, mind manipulation, persuasion.
What was the mind fist thing you found today?
Well, there's this weird writer who writes about ninja techniques, and one of his books is called Mind Fist.
So you punch someone in the face with your mind? Is that the whole concept?
Essentially. I've never got more than a couple of pages into his books because they're crazy. But you can go and buy these instructional books that teach you how to deceive people. And there's something fundamentally wrong with that. I mean,
oh, of course
it's
kind is.
Of, it's fun to try these tricks out on your friends.
Yeah.
But, you know, obviously people are getting good at them and going out and exploiting people. The example that I saw when I traveled to Rome, and I remember this, this was in my early 20s. I traveled all throughout Europe. And
did a guy with a big ring come up to your wave in front of your face?
Very similar. People warned us before we went to Rome to watch out for the gypsies.
And
I thought,
really?
Yeah, very funny. But as soon as we got there, yeah, they're everywhere, like begging for money, and they're surrounding you. So it's really easy to get pickpocketed.
Yeah.
But I remember there was a guy, an American tourist, and he had an expensive camera around his neck.
Mm-hmm.
And a couple of the young girls went up to him and they were tugging on his camera, pulling it, trying to pull it from his neck. And I thought, that's a really crappy way to pickpocket someone.
Yeah.
But then, you know, just reading the story and doing this segment, I realized they weren't trying to take his camera. They were just distracting him by pulling his camera.
Right.
So that someone else could get into his pocket and steal his wallet.
I didn't even think of that, but you're right. You'd be focused on the expensive piece of equipment around your neck. You'd be focused on that, and then you'd be forgetting about your pockets. It's kind of scary though, isn't it?
Yeah. Just got a little thing for you. Check your back pocket.
You didn't know you didn't. I've got buttons on my back pockets. There's no way you could have gotten in there.
I did actually check, though. I had you worried for a second.
You didn't have me
if you want to find more about gypsy magic, can I make a suggestion? Because we're doing this story and you had it all covered, so I thought, I'll try and find some gypsy news.
Okay.
I went to Kindle, and the only thing I could find that was worth mentioning was a book from Kenna Madison, and it's called Gypsy Curse Gender Swap.
What? just say that again. Gypsy curse.
Gypsy curse.
Gender swap.
Gender swap.
Oh, okay. I can't believe I'm going to ask this, but what is the premise of this book?
Ivan had everything he could ever want. Mm-hmm. He was handsome. Mm-hmm. He had a body to kill for, and women flocked to him like moths to flame.
Lucky bastard.
Every weekend, he and Mike, his best friend and also perfect wingman, would find and bed the most beautiful women around.
So he's a sleaze.
This Friday night, however, would be the night that changed Ivan's life forever. After a gypsy curse, Ivan finds himself inside a woman's body with feelings and desires both new and overwhelming. His friendship with Mike turns into something else entirely and changes him in ways he never imagined.
What the hell?
We'll link to that in the show notes if you want to check it out.
No one wants to check that out. Not even for some morbid curiosity. No one wants to check that
out. It's a shame there isn't more legitimate, you know, gypsy books in the Kindle store.
Well, there actually is a very rich heritage. And I mean, yeah, okay, there is a lot of connections with robbing people and everything else and screwing people around and being transients. Yes, I know that there's all those factors, but you've seen it. I mean, like, there's those documentaries where they look at the gypsies and the Roma and what they've done. They have a very rich cultural history.
It's totally a ridiculous stereotype.
Yeah, it is. Yeah.
I mean, it's not like they're all really good pickpockets and thieves, just most of them.
Oh my God. Well, let's just move away from that as fast as possible. So look, when I think about concepts like that, I actually find that terrifying because I like to think that from an intellectual point of view, that no, not only can I not be hypnotized by someone walking up to me in the street, I like to think that I'm smart enough that I wouldn't be overwhelmed by someone trying to trick me and take something from me. But, you know, we're beginning to learn now that there are so many different parts of the human body that are responsible for our overall interactions with our daily lives. And something that's actually now coming back into vogue in science is the concept that the heart is actually in control as opposed to the mind. And where that comes from is an article that was written in the BBC this week. It's from David Robson, and it's called The Mind-Bending Effects of Feeling Two Hearts.
I thought this was a guy with a weird biological anomaly when I first saw the headline. Like, he actually had two hearts in him.
Yeah, right. Well, technically he does, but he wasn't born with two hearts. He had a failing cardiac muscle. I say his heart was dying and the muscle around his heart was dying. So doctors implanted this small mechanical pump that was meant to relieve the burden of his failing heart. And his name is Carlos, and he disliked this sensation because he said that he always had this feeling in his chest, which is normal. You have your heartbeat in your chest.
Still your heart. Yeah.
But he said it felt like that it dropped from his chest to his tummy. That's his words he actually used. It dropped into his stomach because this little device would throb about his navel and cause this really eerie feeling. And it was really unsettling. But a neuroscientist called Augustin Ibanez met Carlos and actually suspected that the odder effects were yet to come. He believed that because the man's heart had changed, he might also have a change in his mind. He would now think, feel, and act differently as a result of the implant. And you might think, well, how come? Because there is this concept of following the heart, but only recently scientists have begun to show that there might be some truth to the cliche. The heaving lump of muscle contributes to our emotions and mysterious feelings of intuition in a very real way. Everything from having empathy for another person's pain to that hunch that your spouse is having an affair may actually originate from subtle signals that are in your heart rather than it coming from your intellect and from your mind.
Well, they referenced the famous work from William James in the 1800s who essentially founded psychology. His idea was that emotions are this back and forth feedback cycle between the body and the brain. And according to his theory, the brain might be able to register a threat intellectually, but it's our awareness of, you know, the racing heartbeat, mm-hmm. our sweaty palms that creates this visceral emotion. So he wanted to study this, and his studies are obviously well documented, and they asked subjects to count their heartbeats based solely on the feelings within their chest.
So they couldn't touch their chest?
Yeah, they couldn't time it correctly. They just had to kind of guess it based on feel. And not many people got it right. Only a quarter got 80% accuracy. But after they did this test, they would take these people aside and then do cognitive tests on them. Now, people with more bodily awareness, i.e. the people who were more accurate in
knowing their heartbeat,
figuring out how quickly the heart was beating, they tended to have more intense reactions to emotive pictures. They reported being more greatly moved by them. They're also better at describing their feelings. And importantly, this sensitivity seems to extend to others' feelings as well. They're better at recognizing emotions in others' faces, and they're also quicker to learn to avoid a threat. So such as a small electric shock in the lab, perhaps because those more intense bodily feelings saturate their memories, making the aversion more visceral. So it went on to demonstrate that there was a clear connection between body awareness, being in tune with your body, and having a richer, more vivid emotional life.
Yeah, well, that's exactly right. So what scientists are beginning to learn now, that old adage of following your heart might actually have something that has some substance to it. People that are more in touch with their bodies are better at following their instincts, whether they're good or bad. It just means that they followed their instincts. Mm. And of course, Ibanez wanted to work out whether or not being fitted with an artificial heart for Carlos would have caused differences for him. So they got him to tap out his pulse. And he followed out the machine's rhythms rather than his own heartbeat. So he wasn't listening to his own heart. He was listening to the device because he actually could easily feel it.
He could feel it pulsing in his stomach.
Exactly. But they found when they conducted exactly the same tests that they did on the other test subjects that he had a significantly changed set of social and emotive skills. For example, he seemed to lack empathy when he viewed pictures of people having a painful accident, and he also had more general problems with the ability to read others' motives, and crucially, he lacked intuitive decision-making, which all seems to be in line with emotive cognition, which is this new big word that's coming up in psychology now. And we've all had those feelings. We've all been like, why the hell did I just do that? Intellectually, I know that's really stupid, but sometimes the heart rules the mind, but we're beginning to see why now. And one theory could be is that it's actually a physical effect. There is a nerve that runs between the heart and up to the mind. Obviously there is. But if that is damaged, whether from a transplant or if it's damaged from the heart or cardiac failure, well, then it might actually cut off the internal signals that are being sent between the heart and the brain, and the brain actually loses a sense. It loses its own timing, and unfortunately, these problems come about where people, I'm not going to say turn into, you know, social klutzes, but certainly they lose their intuition and their emotive abilities.
Wasn't there examples later on of this leading to depressive disorders as well? Like if you struggle to detect your own heartbeat, you're more likely to suffer from depression.
Well, they actually got a group of people that were suffering from a depressive illness, and they trained them not only in cognitive behavioral therapy so that they can improve their mood, but they also got them to focus on their hearts and count out their heartbeats. They then got these people and then sent them outside, essentially. And we know from we know from other studies that if you go and if you walk through a beautiful park and there's birds singing and there's sun and all that kind of nice stuff, you should feel good. But they found that the depressed clients, even after they've been taught these skills, weren't able to count their heart rate, probably weren't in touch with their heart, still remained depressed. They remained empty and their intuition was significantly reduced as opposed to those people who were better in touch with their heart rate and had also undergone this therapy. So we don't know why we have this bodily awareness, but many scientists think that it can be trained with practice and it might actually become a new mindfulness-based therapy where people can focus on their sensations inside their body. So it also allows for introspection as well. Again, there's no cognitive reasoning behind this, and even top scientists don't understand why this is happening, but they certainly believe that your heart is actually in your body to act as an emotional barometer. It informs you about your state of mind, and it also tells you how to act. You actually can enjoy a richer, more emotional life, being tuned into sensory pleasures of the world and make better decisions. All you have to do is simply listen to your heart, which is so cliche, but they've now got scientific data to start backing it up.
It actually feels like it's coming full circle and almost falling in line with what you would see in perhaps some Eastern medicine, for example.
Oh, really?
Where there's the concept of heart thinking. And there's the idea that, you know, your spirit or your consciousness can move around in the body. And usually for us, it's in our head. So it feels like our brain's doing the processing. And of course, our brain's, you know, doing the processing for our consciousness. But in other cases,
intuitions?
Well, exactly. Well, if it moves around and it feels like your heart's thinking, is it then being processed by the brain? Are those thoughts still going through, you know, the factory that is our brain?
Yeah, exactly. Well, I mean, maybe the brain, even if we just look at this from a very fundamental biological point of view, maybe the brain simply is doing the processing, but it's receiving signals from other locations. And we know that the heart, well, okay, we think the heart is just there to pump blood around the body. Maybe there's more to it than that, but we just don't understand that yet. But maybe because our body does have that fight or flight response, we do react to things which cause our heart rates to go up. That sends a signal to the brain, and that could actually be something as subtle as intuition.
So this is another example where we can see emerging technologies start to interfere with normal rhythms and functions of the biological body that we haven't anticipated yet. Like I saw an article today that referenced a quote from Larry Page who said a couple of years ago that in the future he sees everyone having some kind of neural implant. It's just a given that we're going to have that. Like, if you think of a fact, this implant is going to give you the correct answer instantly. And yeah, this is an example of we don't fully understand the biological system yet. The human body still has many mysteries that we're yet to unlock, and yet we're starting to interfere with it in ways that could disrupt it greatly.
This is very much the dangers of transhumanism, and you know that I'm a proponent of it. I think that overall it's a great thing, but you're right, there is still so much even now that we don't understand, and I think that it's going to be 200 or 300 years more of medical science before we even begin to understand where the body is connected, why things happen, how it happens, and how we interact with the world. When we start messing with it with electricity, you know, it adds this new element to it where there's a lot of risks that are going to be involved.
Here's another medical mystery, just to close off this segment. Edward Baker, rugby player from the UK.
Mm.
He had broken his nose so many times, he lost his sense of smell 20 years ago.
Right.
He was playing a game last weekend, got kicked in the head.
Yep.
As you do.
Yep.
Sense of smell comes back. Saved his life.
How?
He went home and he smelled a gas leak in the street.
Yeah.
And it saved his life because they came and fixed the gas leak.
That's not medical mysteries. That's just synchronicity. You know, like, that's a weird woodja coincidence that happens.
Sometimes a kick in the head can save your life.
That's good to know.
We'll leave you with that thought as we go to our break. We've got a lot more coming up after this. I'm going to be talking about getting lost in other dimensions where you don't get coverage for Google Maps.
Oh, there's nothing worse.
It's very inconvenient.
Yeah, incredibly so.
Can't get turn by turn directions in other dimensions. That's coming up after this. Stay with us. I slowly looked down. Where there used to be thick chest muscles, there were now full breasts. I leaned over and looked at my crotch. My manhood was gone.
What the hell are you reading?
In its place with these...
That better not be the Skinwalker book.
No, this is a Gypsy Curse gender swap.
Oh, why are we back there again?
Just a sneak peek. What's coming up in the 24 pages of this
24 pages long
rip-roaring Kindle novel.
Great. Just great.
Free if you enjoy Kindle Unlimited.
Oh, God.
Which I did, which is why I have access.
Why would you even want it if it was free?
No, actually, the book I wanted to talk about today, I stumbled across. It's called Lost on Skinwalker Ranch. And I thought, oh, good, another Skinwalker book. That's all we need. But actually, reading through this, it was a different twist on the whole Skinwalker story.
In what way?
Well, it was written by, from an expat, and it's actually ghostwritten by Eric Retz. Mm-hmm. And he claims he's living in Peru, and he meets up with other expats all the time, and they run little businesses there. And there's an expat named Riley who they became friends.
Yeah.
And one night they went out drinking together, and Riley, in this drunken state, starts telling him this story about Skinwalker Ranch. And Riley claims that he was a security guard at the Skinwalker Ranch. Now, Eric, being a writer, says, well, I can tell your story. I've ghostwritten for authors before. I can tell your story. Let's get it out there. And Riley was reluctant at first, but then realized, you know, my non-disclosure agreement has now timed out. I can actually tell this story. And if you're kind of unfamiliar with the history behind the Skinwalker Ranch,
a lot of weird stuff happened there, to say the least.
That's one way to put it. It's the name given to a piece of property in Utah. It was purchased from its principal owner by a man and wife who wanted to raise cattle. Over the approximate 2 years that they lived there with their two children, they experienced one strange an unexplainable event after the other, including UFO sightings, weird cryptids, animals for which nature has no answer, sentient orbs, light anomalies, disappearing livestock, pets, disembodied voices, beings that seem to materialize out of the air, and gypsies.
There were no gypsies, well, maybe one.
Convinced that they and their children were in danger, the property was sold to a wealthy real estate and aerospace investor by the name of Bigelow.
Oh, of course, Bigelow Aerospace bought that property.
So, of course, when Bigelow bought the ranch, he wanted to look into the strange phenomena going on. Well, as we've covered on the show many times before, he's very much a believer in the UFO phenomenon, wants to capture a UFO so he can reverse engineer it for his aerospace company.
You can't blame him. I mean, he's not Grumpy Cat's owner, is he?
And he wanted to discourage thrill seekers and, you know, local kids from going on to the property, ghost hunters and the like. So he hired a team of security guards to patrol the 500 acres that he had purchased.
Because I remember we did a story on that, right? Because there were people that were trying to go and just, you know, skylark, I suppose, around the ranch. And there was all of this stuff coming out that there was these big burly bodyguards that were scaring people away. And you know, it's fair enough. It's private property now. But I remember it was actually pretty hardcore security. And you and I speculated as to why would he put that much security into this ranch?
Well, I remember the last time we did a Skinwalker book. It was so fantastic that it was really fun to talk about.
Yeah.
It was the one where there was this giant wolf-like creature.
That's right.
Was basically ready to attack this family, and the father shot it several times with a high-powered gun, and it wasn't affected by it. There were sightings of strange pterodactyl-like creatures, you know, going off into the dark. There were always weird footprints around their homestead, and the footprints would be followed and then suddenly disappear.
Were there winged men sitting in trees, I think?
Yeah, all sorts.
Glowing red eyes and
orbs and UFOs and portals and entries to other dimensions, all that good stuff. So reading through this, I was kind of set up for, okay, here we go. This is going to be another wild ride. But as I started to look into these early chapters, it was all very mundane and believable. Riley was taking us through the process of getting hired. He had had a terrible breakup with his wife, and he was looking to find some other work. He was a former military guy, former military police, and a friend had recommended this role for security for Bigelow Aerospace.
Which is all pretty normal, right? That's what people do. They leave the military, they go into private contracting.
Yeah.
It all is logical.
So in 2009, he went along to the interview, and he describes going into this interview room in Las Vegas. It was just off the Tropicana. And there was a guy in there with an Irish accent who was asking him all these questions. And there was another federal-looking guy, he said, who claimed to be former FBI or CIA or some other three-letter, you know, collection.
Yeah.
But he was very, very serious. The whole thing was really serious. And they were asking him the standard questions for about half an hour. But then all of a sudden they started asking him about UFOs. What do you think of UFOs?
Which is obviously unusual for a job interview.
Yeah. Do you believe in UFOs? And he was like, well, I guess so. I don't see what this has to do with anything. And then they asked him, what do you think of spirits? Do you believe in spirits? So he tried to just be truthful, and he could tell that they were deadly serious about this. So he said, well, actually, I have this kind of reoccurring dream. And some nights I feel like I'm awake. I can see around my room, but my body can't move. And there's this strange shadow-like figure at the end of my bed.
Oh, and it sounds like an old hag syndrome.
I have this, you know, looming feeling of impending doom.
Yep.
And I sit up in bed and I try and punch it and it's gone.
Mm-hmm.
And I realize I'm covered in sweat and I'm awake and it was just a dream. And he says this reoccurs, and you're right, it totally sounds like old hag syndrome and sleep paralysis. And they kind of take this on board, and he believes it helped him to get the job in a way, because in the end he said, I guess it could be a spirit.
Right, yeah.
So they saw he was open-minded, and it turns out he gets the job.
Well, I guess you'd have to be open-minded, right, working at the Skinwalker Ranch.
Well, he wasn't really told too much about the ranch. And when he first started, he had his training in Las Vegas, because Bigelow, they have their aerospace outfit in Las Vegas, and he owns a couple of buildings there. And he did just very routine security work in those buildings for 3 weeks.
Right.
But eventually, he's called up to do his tour of the ranch.
Yeah.
And the way they figured the security was they had two guys posted for 2 weeks on the ranch, and they would do night shifts as well. And then they would rotate out for 2 weeks, and they'd send two other guys in there.
Okay.
So he goes out to the ranch and he meets the guy he's going to be working with. His name's Mark, and he's done several shifts there. And he mentions briefly some of the strange things he's seen, like some weird entity run out of one of the barns and lights in the sky and orbs.
Mm-hmm.
But Riley's very skeptical about this, and he really just wants to get his shift done. And they explain that, well, his main job is to patrol the grounds, and if he sees any trespassers, to call the police so that the police can come and, you know, get
trespass
involved.
Trespass them off. Yeah.
Get rid of them. So, you know, days go by, and he sees a pair of headlights and kind of shines his torch on them, and they drive away. He sees a couple of kids with torch lights and, you know, tells them to leave. But after a while, it starts to get kind of strange. There's a point where he's going around the grounds during the day with Mark, and they come across this series of prints. And Mark says to him, "Have you ever seen prints like that before?" And they look closer at these prints, and the best way he can describe them is they look like bowling pins.
Oh.
Bowling pins. But it's not from a four-legged animal. It's something bipedal, walking with bowling pin-shaped feet.
Yeah, right.
And it's the usual thing where they follow the prints, and then the prints just stop.
Yeah, like it disappeared.
There's no explanation of where they went, where they came from, what the animal is, and why it looks bipedal. And Mark's kind of used to this stuff and just says to Riley, "They don't call it Skinwalker Ranch for nothing," then just walks away.
And nonchalant.
Riley's like, what? Okay. What is going on? So remember in the interview, he mentioned that he was having these reoccurring old hag syndrome events throughout his life. He was having these reoccurring dreams of this figure looming over his bed and then waking him up. Well, during his time at the ranch, after a few days, these started to occur every night. Every night he would have the old hag syndrome sleep paralysis event happen, and he would see this large, hulking, shadow-like humanoid looming over his bed, and it would feel horrible, like this thing wanted to destroy his soul, and then he would wake up trying to punch it.
Yeah.
And the other security guard, Mark, started to realize that he was waking up suddenly during the night. And eventually he was coming into his room going, "Look, what's going on? Why are you yelling out in the middle of the night?" And this was happening at 3 in the morning, 4 in the morning. And Riley, you know, confided in Mark and told him about his reoccurring dream. So because they were encouraged to try and capture strange activity on the ranch, Mark said, "Well, let's set up a video camera and see what happens." So Riley says, "Why not? Let's do this. The activity just seems to be getting worse." So they set up the video camera, and fair enough, the next night, bam, he has this horrible nightmare where this humanoid figure is looming over him. He wakes up kicking and screaming and tries to kick it and punch it, and it dissipates in front of him. It disappears.
But this is all in his dream state that we know of at the moment, right?
It's like a hypnagogic hallucination. Yeah. I mean, that's what it sounds like.
Yeah.
And we've covered these stories a million times in the past.
Yeah.
But this time he had a camera running.
And?
So he wakes up at 4 in the morning. He gets up. He's like, turns the camera off. Doesn't worry about it until morning. And when he wakes up, he goes to the bathroom and has his shower. And as he comes out, Mark says to him, "You have to see this. Come and see this." So Riley says, "I stood behind Mark looking down and past his shoulder at the monitor there on the work table. It took me a second to orient myself to figure out what I was looking at. There was just enough light to make out the outline of my body beneath the blankets, a portion of which were tinted green by the glow of the clock, which was just out of the frame to the left." Mark says, "Watch this, watch this." Suddenly there at the end of the bed, as if appearing out of nowhere, there was this commotion of these small illuminated orbs, all red in color and no bigger than my fist, if even that big. I'm tempted to say that they were pulsating, but that's not the right word. Animated might be a better description. Either way, the light they were emitting wasn't all that intense, but it was definitely a light and not a surface light. It was clearly showing from the inside out. Altogether, I counted 8, maybe 10 of these things. It was hard to be sure. They would fade in random order and without pattern. The light extinguished completely, only to be replaced by another, or perhaps it was the same ones reappearing in a different location. Nevertheless, I watched for a few more seconds as the orbs continued to do their thing. Then almost as soon as they came, they were gone. And in their place was this amorphous shape, visible only by a deeper darkness against the dark of the room. There was no denying that it had the form of a man, or at least a man-like being, and was perhaps as tall and as wide. Even shaped only by an absence of light, you could see where the head was and the torso and the extremities. It was animated and moving, if not very much, almost as if unsure of its purpose. Then the very next instant, you can see me jerk up out of the bed, and in a blink of an eye, the red orbs return and this amorphous mass fizzles out in the darkness.
So, I mean, this is pretty scary because it makes you think that there's a physical manifestation occurring to an experience that he's had for a long time. And is it that the phenomena, maybe, because some of the speculation has been in the past, that the Skinwalker Ranch itself is a portal, a dimensional doorway, I don't know what the word would be for it, but it is a entry for something to come through. Is it that now he's in that particular location, whatever has been harassing him before can get through a lot easier?
Well, he's sitting there watching this video and it's all coming so fast that he's like, I don't understand this. What is happening? And Mark says, well, did you see the most important part? And he's like, well, what's the most important part? And he says, look at this amorphous black figure. See how it's blocking out your bed frame. And then they realize that it was a physical manifestation. You're totally right. It was physically there. It was blocking the view of the bed.
Yeah.
So they're like, there was someone physically in the room. So immediately they both stand up, they go into his room and they start investigating. Mark's a former police officer and Riley's former military police.
So they know how to find anything.
They know how to investigate a crime scene. So they start looking around and instinctively Mark checks the window, the only window to the room. You know, and it's locked.
Yeah.
It's locked. But as he's looking out, like he kind of starts wiping off the moisture so he can see outside. And he says to Riley, you got to see this. And they look outside and there's a pair of bowling pin shaped footprints.
No.
Leading away from the window.
Nope.
So they both start freaking out, but they're there to do a job. I mean, that's why Bigelow hired them, because weird stuff was reported on this ranch. They were there to protect the property, but also document anything they find.
Yep.
So they get on their coats and it's freezing outside. You know, these are prints in the snow. It's like 10 degrees Fahrenheit. So they put on all their gear and they start following these tracks. Now they follow these tracks to a frozen river. And again, the tracks just stop. So Mark says, well, maybe this thing took a left and it went down the frozen river. And Riley's just like, I need to go. This is insane.
Yeah, I've had enough.
And this was only like a week into his 2-week shift.
Mm-hmm.
And the dreams continued. You know, every single night he would have this face waking him up, or he would always wake up suddenly as if a loud noise had startled him. And he said over the coming days, he became more and more stressed and, you know, burnt out because he was sleep deprived.
Yeah.
He was absolutely sleep deprived by this phenomenon.
And to a degree, you're being traumatized by whatever this thing is.
So his 2 weeks are up and he flies back to visit his parents for 2 weeks, decides, I'll just get away. And, you know, his marriage had kind of fizzled out. So he just wanted to spend some time with his parents who lived in Texas. Now, he describes how he's running some errands for his father and he goes grocery shopping. And as he's driving past this old bar, this thought pops into his head of, I need to have a quick drink.
Right.
He doesn't really understand why, but he decides to go in anyway and have a beer. He knows the bartender well. So Riley goes in and sits down and the bartender, you know, serves him his drink. And he's sitting there for about 10 minutes and out of nowhere, like literally out of nowhere, this strange character just pops into the bar. Like just manifests. And Riley's kind of shocked. He turns around and there's this strange Indian guy. He's got, you know, long black hair, kind of really old sunken skin. He's wearing really old fashioned clothing, like old boots, old pants, and a large old fashioned jacket with big brass buttons on it.
Okay.
And the bartender's shocked as well. The bartender kind of looks up and is like, oh, where did this guy come from? And just says, I'll be with you in a minute. This strange Indian character sits right down next to Riley, like the stool next to him. And he orders a drink. He orders I can't remember the name, but it was like he asked for a number 27 or something, like an
old fashioned name for a drink.
Really old name for Jack Daniels.
Yeah.
And Riley's like, why did he ask? I've never heard that before. So he gets served the drink. And to pay for it, this old Indian character pulls out a big stack of notes and he hands it over to the bartender. And the bartender takes it and starts walking to the cash register and then stops in his tracks. He's like, are you sure you want to give this to me? And Riley's, you know, paying attention to all this. And he looks over and he's given him silver dollars, like five silver dollars, this really old, beautiful bill, this really ancient note, like from the 1800s, incredibly rare and probably worth thousands of dollars today. And the Indian guy just goes, last time I checked, it was worth $5. Are you going to take it or not?
Yeah, I want my drink.
So the bartender goes, okay. And again, this is like mint condition. You know, the colors are all bright and it looks like it was just printed. The bartender slides it under the cash register and this Indian guy sits down and starts drinking his Jack Daniels. Now, Riley's sitting there and he's kind of creeped out by this guy. He's getting bad vibes off this character. And he starts to smell this musty kind of smell. And he's like, what is that? He starts to turn and look at the Indian guy next to him. And as he starts to turn, the Indian guy's turning and looking at him.
Awkward.
And this most bizarre exchange starts to occur. This Indian character says, just out of the blue, if I said I had a proposition that could be profitable to the two of us, would you be interested?
Is he trying to pick him up?
And he says, there's just something about him I can't put my finger on. I can usually look into a person's eyes and get a pretty good read, but not this guy. His eyes were odd. First of all, they had the darkest quality to them I'd ever seen. They were nearly coal black. The whites of his eyes, however, were just the opposite. They were yellow, like the eyes of, you know, ancient people, old people. And he wouldn't make direct eye contact when talking with me either. He was always looking over at the TV or something else. And as for the way he talked, his voice had this distinct inflection and he had a funny way of putting his words together. He really made me think of Yoda, he said. He just spoke in a really strange way, like old-fashioned. So Riley says, well, it depends on what the proposition is. He's intrigued. So this Indian guy, he reaches into his breast pocket on the left side of his shirt. He takes out a coin, which he then hands to Riley and says, what do you think this is worth? Now he looks over at the coin, he's flipping it over and he can see it's not a US coin. It had the name Carlos III on it and some writing on the back and it was dated at 1804. The Indian turns to him and says, it's a Spanish coin, and added, what if I told you I know where there's many more of these? And not only these, but different ones, some of solid gold. Now, Riley says he's intrigued.
Of course you would be.
He said, I'd have to say, why tell me? And he's like, well, you mean a stranger? And he says, yeah, why tell a stranger? And he says, well, let's just say you wanted to have your wife killed and you didn't want to do it yourself. Would you ask your brother or an acquaintance to do it? Or would you perhaps look to a stranger? Riley's like, yeah, that's a pretty weird thing to say.
That's kind of morbid, but yeah, that makes sense.
To a stranger. And he's like, well, where is this buried treasure? And the Indian looks down at his glass and he says, I never said it was buried. It's in a place called Indian Canyon on a reservation. There's a string of caves along a hidden ridge that very few know. Nonetheless, the area in general is watched closely by the Bureau of Land Management and Reservation Police. Riley said, I felt he was being evasive. I said, there's a lot of reservations around here and lots of canyons. And he said, this time our eyes met. And he said, it's not around here. It's in Utah, just outside of this reservation.
Ah.
And the location he gave was like a few minutes from the Skinwalker Ranch. So Riley lies and said, never heard of it. I don't know what you're talking about.
Yeah.
And he's starting to freak out because he realizes there's something odd going on. Like, this guy's just come in out of the blue and asked me to find some weird buried treasure
which
in
just
Utah.
Happens to be near where I work.
5 minutes from the Skinwalker Ranch. Yeah. What is going on? So he starts to freak out. He's like, I need to go to the bathroom. He stands up, goes to the bathroom. When he comes back, the Indian's gone.
Right.
He says to the bartender, what happened to the guy? Where'd he go? The bartender said he just got up and left and said he's going to contact you when you're in Utah.
Okay.
He's like, oh, crap. So he looks down and he had left the coin behind. So Riley takes the coin. The bartender keeps the old note.
Yeah, bet you it does.
And he goes back home to his parents' place, doesn't really think about it. So that's really strange, but doesn't really think about it. So weeks go past and he's ready for his next shift at the Skinwalker Ranch. Now, he had forgotten about this Indian guy, totally forgotten about it. And he's doing his shift this time with another guy. And this other guy has stories of seeing lights and orbs around and all sorts of strange stuff. And nothing strange really happens, but the dreams start coming up again. The reoccurring old hack syndrome starts coming up again. But the new security guard he's with this time says, look, I had to wake you up last night because you were screaming. And as I was about to go into your room, I saw, and I'm not joking, I saw a large humanoid-shaped black shape go through your door into your room.
Oh, wow.
When I opened the door, I could still see it there at the foot of your bed. And as I opened the door, it dissipated into the corner and I woke you up and you tried to punch me in the face.
Yeah. So there's definitely something there that's harassing him.
So this other security guard's seeing something weird going on. And a few days after that, one of the other people that was living on the ranch comes up to them and says, look, I have to show you something. So they get up in the morning and they do like a tour of the homestead. They walk around where they're sleeping. And there's all these coyote footprints that have come up to Riley's window.
Yeah.
And they're studying these tracks. And it looks like some of the tracks are bipedal mixed in with a pack of coyotes.
Oh, this is weird.
So they really don't know what's going on. So they start following these tracks. And eventually the pack kind of splits off. And they're just following these two sets of tracks. And again, they both look humanoid.
Yeah.
But there's this strange shape. I still think it looks kind of looks like a coyote print, but they're bipedal.
Yeah.
What's going on? So they're following these tracks, and the tracks lead to this old, worn-out homestead. It's the woods rotting. It's been abandoned for years. There's nothing in there. And they follow the tracks, and they go to the door, and they're like, they must still be in there. You know, we've got to go in and check to see if these coyotes are in there.
Yeah, who was up against the window?
They eventually go in and the tracks, they can still see them on the wood. There's still snow on the tracks and they can see where they've led to. And the tracks lead into this closet, this kind of rotting old closet in this homestead, and then disappear. And Riley's looking at them going, what is going on? These coyotes that got in here, where did they go?
Why are they walking into a closet?
And this is where the other security guard's like, well, they just vanished, as if it's not a big deal. And Riley's pushing him, going, what do you mean they just vanished? This is impossible. There's no tracks going out. There's nowhere they could have gone. They can't fly up into the sky. Where did they go?
Yeah.
And the other security guard says, well, the locals say this is where one of the portals is.
Oh, so he's already been accustomed to whatever's going on. So he just accepts it.
He's heard the story.
Right.
Yeah, he's heard of this stuff before. So Riley's just bamboozled by this. He goes back to their trailers in their homestead and continues on touring the property, just going about his normal work duty. A couple of days go past and he's out again near one of these homesteads, and he sees this light ahead of him, and he sees two bright glowing golden balls, like orbs, floating in the air, and they just hover in front of him. So it's like the size of beach balls.
Yeah.
And he's freaking out. He gets out his phone to take a photo, and as soon as he looks at his phone and glances back up, these things have disappeared. Mm-hmm. He's kind of excited about this, but he gets this feeling come over him, like this ominous feeling, almost as if he's terrified. You know how people who claim they're in the forest, they feel like someone's watching them. He just feels creepy, right? So he's about to head back towards the trailers and retire for the evening. And he gets this musty smell, the smell of wet dog.
Which was like he experienced in that bar.
Yeah, the same thing as he smelt with that Indian guy in the bar. And he says, I saw movement coming from the trees. And all of a sudden, two dark shapes, thin and upright, came towards me. He said, had my flashlight been working, I would have shined it upon them because the orbs had shut down his phone and his flashlight. As I stepped into the clearing and into the moonlight, I nearly shit myself. This sick feeling hit me in the pit of my stomach and washed outward, wobbling my legs as if they were going to collapse beneath my weight. It was kind of like that feeling you get on the roller coaster when it hits the first big drop and tickles you right down to the bladder. My vision went tunnel on me, and it took all the training I could muster not to piss myself where I stood. I want to say they look like coyotes, sort of. Keep in mind, though, at this point, I wasn't trusting my own eyes or what my brain was telling me I was looking at. These things were almost my height, standing upright on skinny legs with bony L-shaped knees, if they were knees at all, and they were up on their toes like spastic ballerinas. Their torsos were too long for their legs and emaciated as if they had never eaten. They had these round protruding bellies, almost like the kind you see on starving kids, and the chest was angular as if looking down on a pointed roof. The skin was patchy with thin hair and scaled with mange, sucked in between the rib bones. Their arms weren't much different than the legs, elbows bony like the knees, only sticking out to the sides like chicken wings, so that the forearms and paws were forced in towards the body and outward like kangaroo arms. There was no neck to speak of, as if their heads had been nestled between their tapering shoulders, except they were jutting forward as if the things were craning to get a better look. Their muzzles were much shorter and weirder looking than you'd expect from canines, as if they were a sickly imitation of people, but still way too dog-like. Both had their lips drawn back in a half-snarl, half-grin, with yellow fangs showing. Their eyes reflected a jaundiced yellow, their irises dark and beady. The ears were all canine, short and pointed. And there was no escaping that smell, like a raccoon had been hit by a car, its three-day-old carcass hidden by tall weeds but still reeking in the summer heat. Now, having some degree of sense and sanity, he said, I took the glove off my right hand, my movement slow and controlled, and he starts reaching for his pistol. Now, he said, as I did so, I started slowly stepping backwards, thinking that my best bet was to make it back to the homestead, you know, one of these rotting homesteads behind him.
Yeah.
At the very least, I would have the walls to my back. As I took my first step back, the thing to my left responded by circling to its right, its movement spastic and ungainly, but quicker and with greater agility than I would have had thought possible. And it forced me to turn to my left, leaving me exposed to the opposite side where the second one was. I backpedaled as fast as I could to keep them both in my line of sight. It worked as they both froze, as if confused or maybe just being cautious. Still, they were both positioned so that I had to keep my head turning from side to side. So he's in a standoff with these two canine humanoids approaching him.
Mm.
He starts to back away, and I love the description of the way they moved. Like,
yeah,
they're just borrowing
gangling,
these
weird,
spastic movement. Like, they're jerking these crazy bodies around. And at this point, they're kind of not moving towards him, but he pulls his gun up and starts pointing his gun at them.
Which is practically going to be useless against a supernatural entity if they actually exist.
And he said they started advancing on him. They started moving towards him. But the way they moved, it was almost as if they were gliding above the snow towards him.
Mm-hmm.
So he's freaking out, obviously. You know, this is terrifying him. He says they have this kind of grin and snarl on their faces. So he starts firing off shots and he swears he's hitting them in the chest, but they're not affected at all.
Yeah.
They show no reaction at all to being hit by bullets, which was the similar story we'd covered on the bus.
Yeah, exactly.
That Skinwalker report.
Don't respond to it at all.
So he decides to just run for it. He turns and sprints for the homestead. And he reached the opening where the door had once been, and he leaps into the darkness. He said, no sooner had my boot hit the surface of the floor, this large black mass rushed towards my face. Before I could even get my hands up, I was hit by this stifling billow of air. Only there was no air. It was as if I drew in a full breath of heavy soil or mud. My lungs expanded with a sudden heaviness. I couldn't exhale. I found myself gulping nothing. I started to panic, military experience or not, as the pressure built at my temples and the lightheadedness became dizziness, and I had the sensation of spiraling downward. I was aware that my lungs were burning, but it was all so distant that it seemed more a curiosity than a worry, as was the deniable fact that I was on the verge of losing consciousness. But he said, I didn't. Well, at least I don't think I did. He has no sense of any missing time. And remember, he's had this experience. This thing's attacked him in this old homestead. And he's kind of hit the ground. And he remembers his cheek touching the rotten wood. But now he kind of comes to, and his cheek's on hard, cold stone.
Right.
And he kind of gets up and looks around. He's like, where on earth am I? And he describes being in this strange glowing tunnel.
Did he go into the portal?
Now, if you think that the advancing humanoid canines are weird,
yeah,
and the strange Indian with his old currency is weird,
yeah,
that's nothing.
Why?
This is where the story gets really strange, because he's describing being in what is essentially this strange dimension. He's surrounded in a cave, but he says that his vision is completely warped in that everything seems like it's amber colored.
Right.
But he has no depth perception. It's like his depth perception is completely warped. So he can see that the corner of this cave that he's in is there. But if he starts to walk towards it, it doesn't get any closer.
Mm.
And he's describing this cave-like system that he's in, where it's almost like a hallway, and there's only really one way to go, because if he goes back the other way, it's getting narrower and narrower and he won't be able to fit.
Yeah.
So he's like, I have to go in this direction. But it's so strange because he feels like he's walking on a treadmill. He's just in one spot. He walks for half an hour and he's like,
I'm still in the same spot. Where have I gotten?
I feel like I haven't moved.
Yeah.
And he's stopping for a second and just trying to take stock of what's happened. He's like, okay, I can breathe. I'm alive. I can feel my heartbeat. I'm not hungry or thirsty. There's no sound. I can't really hear anything moving. But I physically feel like I'm in this cave. So what he did was he held his left hand out and he put his hand on the side of this wall that he could touch and put his right hand on the ceiling that he could touch. And he just walked forward and used those sensations as a guide. Still felt like he was going on a treadmill, but at least he knew he was moving because he could feel the smooth surface of this cavern along his fingertips. So he's walking and walking and walking, and it feels like his concept of time is gone. He doesn't know how long this is taking. And eventually he makes it to this point where he can see something different, and he sees a set of steps going downwards, these stone steps. So he describes, you know, long story short, because this section of the book goes for ages, he describes going down these steps and coming out into this strange cavern. There's like canyon walls on each side. And he's outside, but he looks up and it's not like Earth's sky.
Right.
There's some strange vortex of swirling dark mists. And if he looks up for too long, he starts to get nauseous because of the way it's moving. It's completely throwing him off. So he thinks, what can I do? He keeps walking in the desert, this strange other dimension desert.
Well, what else are you going to do? I mean, you don't know where you are.
And he's, again, the depth perception is off. Everything's amber colored. It's got this strange swirling sky above him. And as he's walking along, and it feels like weeks that he's walking, he can see off to the side canyon, like caves in the canyon.
Oh, wait a minute. And, as in like the, what the Indian guy in the bar described?
Well, he can see fires and he can see humanoid shapes, so he thinks they're people, but he starts to walk towards them, and he doesn't get any closer. It's like he's stuck on a treadmill. It's almost like he's not built for this dimension.
Yeah.
You know, he doesn't know how to navigate wherever he is with his crappy physical body.
Yeah.
But he is making some progress. So eventually he gets to a point where there's like a fissure in the canyon and he can get close to it. He kind of gets on his hands and knees and he crawls up to this opening in the canyon wall. And he looks inside and he sees two strange little people. And they're like humans, but they're tiny. They're like hobbits, right? And they're doing this ceremony where they're dancing. One of them's beating a drum and there's a big cauldron and a fire going.
What the hell?
This is the weirdest thing I've ever read. And in between them, there's a normal-sized person wrapped in all these bandages, like a mummy, right? So they're doing this ceremony. He's just watching it going, what is going on? Where am I? What the hell's happening to me? And they look like they're doing this invocation ceremony. And out of the flames of this fire emerges this black humanoid. And he realizes it's the entity from my dreams.
Oh.
And then as this is happening and he feels this fear come over him, he's like, oh, this is it. This is just this horrible fear, worse than what he felt being faced by the canines. And this mummified human-shaped person sits up and the mouth just goes, oh. So this crazy horror story, right? So as soon as that happens, he blanks out.
Yeah.
He blanks out and he feels someone reviving him. He feels someone holding his hand and he slowly opens his eyes and he's in hospital. He's in a Utah hospital and the nurse is there looking after him and he's got an IV hooked up to him. There's no one around that he recognizes in the hospital room, but eventually his workmates and the guys that hired him, they come in, a couple of scientists come in and he's like,
what the hell?
What the hell happened to me?
Yeah.
And they're asking him, well, what do you remember? And he describes, he tells them as much as he can and leaves out the canines. He leaves all that out. He just said, I kind of slipped and hit my head in the cabin. And he said, well, what happened to me? What? And they said, you've been missing for 3 days.
Oh, wow.
They thought he was dead.
Yeah.
Because remember, it's so cold. They thought there's no way he could have survived the night. He went missing after the first 24 hours. They set up searches to look for him. They looked everywhere, all over the property. They were searching in the homesteads,
he wasn't there.
The old buildings. No sign of the guy. On the third day, they're doing their routine checks. He's in the same building he went missing in. He's just lying there in the homestead, in the rotting homestead, right?
Yeah.
So they said the strangest thing was when they took him to the hospital, he showed all he had was dehydration. And, you know, he hadn't really eaten anything, didn't have any water or food. But his body temperature was normal.
Okay.
Like,
which is not to be expected if you've been lying in an unheated cabin.
The doctor said it was like he had been there for 10 minutes.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, you know, if he had survived in the freezing cold, he would have had hypothermia. You know, he would have showed signs of fighting off the cold. And, you know, they couldn't work out what had happened to him or where he had gone. And this is where, you know, he was taken back to the Las Vegas head office. He was taken back to Bigelow headquarters. He said two scientists for the next 3 weeks took him through questionnaires. They put him onto lie detectors. They gave him hypnosis. And he told them the whole story. He told them about the weird humanoids he had seen. He told them about this other dimension he'd been in with these little people and the strange mummy entity, waking up and the entity. And he said they all just wrote it down like it was normal. Like it was just like, another day at the office.
Oh, that one, yeah.
Yeah, oh yeah, the canines
again. Yeah. Happens all the time.
And eventually he kind of finished his work with them and wrapped up. He obviously didn't want to go back to the ranch. And it, you know, the book starts with him being in South America. So he went to Peru to start a new life.
Right, because obviously something like that would be incredibly traumatizing. So you want to get away.
He wanted to get away from this. But before he left, he was in touch with the Navajo shaman. Right. He wanted to speak to a medicine man to get their perspective on what was going on and who this strange Indian character was.
Like, and the coins.
Who was this guy?
Yeah.
And the medicine man said, those two humanoid canines that you saw, they're skinwalkers.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason that they were so gangly and weird and they had mange and their bodies look like they're rotting is because they're low level. They haven't fully mastered the transformation.
Okay.
And skinwalkers is the idea that, you know, medicine men can transform into beasts and sometimes vice versa. A beast can transform into a man. And he said that the guy that you met in the bar, that was the evil spirit that was turning up in your dreams. That was the black humanoid thing that was following you around and showing up in your old hag experiences.
So why dress as an Indian with, you know, weird buttons and old notes? And
well, he said the reason he gave you that coin is he tried to lure you with treasure. He tried to tempt you. And if you take the coin, like if you would have taken the coin out of his hand, he would have owned you. He would have controlled you through that coin.
Right.
Because you're being tempted by the gold. It's like the old fairy stories from Europe. It's like if you take the gold, you then control
the food as well.
Yeah. So he said the only reason that you were able to get out of this situation and escape this other dimension is because he'd left the gold for you. If you had taken it out of his hand.
So if he'd picked it up.
If you had willingly accepted it, it would have been game over.
Yeah. So what happened to the guy with the $5 note? I wonder if he got screwed over then.
Well, he actually checked with the bartender and the bartender said it just disappeared after a few days and he thought one of his employees had stolen it, but it had just disappeared.
Yep.
And the medicine man said this is how the skinwalkers essentially enslave people. They tempt them with gold, with treasure. And he's saying, you know, I know where this treasure is. I can show you where it is and we can be rich.
Yeah.
So it was a really cool end to the story. And he said when he was in this other dimension and he saw that mummified figure kind of wake up and go, he said that was a representation of his physical body.
Oh.
It was him.
Oh, wow.
And those little humanoids were kind of looking after him, trying to protect him from this spirit.
Wow, that's crazy.
So it's this bizarre, wild, insane story.
You got to take it with a grain of salt, but it truly is an incredible story.
And, you know, coming across other skinwalker stories, like if you've read the full selection of what's available from the people that claim they worked at the Skinwalker Ranch, this is on par with what's out there.
Very much so.
It's just batshit crazy.
Yeah. Yeah.
But what surprised me about this one is
it was well written.
There's a lot of just general mundane stuff in it. Yeah. Like the way he describes it, it really does feel like it's just a guy who sat down at a bar and told you the story.
Sometimes that's where some of the best stories come from as well.
It's a pretty tall tale, but it's really well told. Again, like you said, a grain of salt. I mean, you need to take it with a giant truckload of salt.
Yeah, you do, but I loved it. I think it was entertaining.
Isn't it cool how the humanoid sightings and the descriptions match with what Linda Godfrey gets in her reports?
Yeah.
So maybe
and
there's
some people have alleged that she is encountering skinwalkers as opposed to actual dogmen as well.
Maybe there's something to this. Yeah. I really wish we could get more from Bigelow himself.
Oh, he's never going to release any information, though. I mean, he has an alternative agenda that we're not going to find out about. I mean, he wants to get hold of that technology.
Well, Riley claims that these scientists and engineers that were interviewing him, they were making sketches of what he was describing, and he had like tapes of his hypnotic regression, and he asked for copies of it, and they just said, no, we're never going to release any of this.
Sorry, it's confidential.
And he had that non-disclosure agreement for 5 years.
It makes sense, though. I mean, if you're spending that kind of money, you're investing in this, you're trying to get hold of it, you wouldn't want that getting out. And certainly if you develop some type of spacefaring or interdimensional travel technology, you don't want other people knowing about that.
Crazy story.
Absolutely.
Eric T. Retz, Lost on the Skinwalker Ranch. We'll link to it in the show notes. It is on Kindle Unlimited, so you can get it for free. I really like that service.
Oh, really? Yeah, because you've only just started using it.
Yeah.
Yeah, you're enjoying it.
You get stuff like Gypsy Curse Gender Swap.
I don't want that service if that's all I'm going to get.
And Lost on Skinwalker Ranch. Now, should we take a break or should we just bring it home?
Let's just bring it home.
The wacky stories.
We'll bring it home with the wacky stories.
Okay, so we had a sexy story, but we'll get to that.
Okay. So, Ben, okay, let me bring this one back.
Yeah.
Let's say you're angry at the state. You're angry at your government. You're angry at the way that you've been treated. Well, the best way to deal with that is to punch a $10 million Monet painting.
Yeah, but it wanted to go him.
Andrew Shannon, 49, ruined the Claude Monet masterpiece that was hanging in the National Gallery in Ireland in 2012 by attacking it in front of stunned art lovers. On Thursday, just recently, a court finally brought him to justice for his crime. The painting was valued at $10 million or £7.8 million. Now, he told police after his arrest that he committed the thoughtless act of vandalism because he wanted to get back at the state. But when he was at court, he said, oh no, it was just an accident and I felt faint and I fell into the painting.
He's backpedaling. The Monet
looks like a chav.
It's got a hole in it.
Like, it does. It's ruined.
Right through it. And I love the idea that, there's this chav just, you know, he's like...
He's wearing a tracksuit to court.
He's like, he's trying to fight the painting.
He looks like someone who would punch a Monet.
The painting looked at him sideways. He's like, you what?
This, yeah, exactly. Yeah. What, you're fucking having a laugh?
Oh, God, that's so bad.
Sorry. So he has now been sentenced to 5 years in prison and he's not allowed to go into the gallery for 15 months after his release. I would say he should get a lifetime ban. You know me, I'm not really a big fan of art, but classical art, like stuff like Monet and Matisse, to destroy that is just horribly criminal.
Well, speaking of art.
Well, this is what I don't like about art.
I think you need to take that guy who's known for punching art and
into this gallery.
take him to some modern art galleries. So Usher, famous R&B legend Usher, was in the news recently.
He needs to be punched for bringing Justin Bieber into the world, but that's beside the point.
He was charging his iPhone from a woman's vagina.
Sorry? Yeah, I was just about to drink water.
This occurred at the Art Basel Museum in Miami. He paid $20 in exchange for 10 minutes of juice on Wednesday night. A crowd of distinguished art enthusiasts stood by and watched the entire thing.
There's a naked woman sitting there with a lightning cable coming out of her cooch plugged into his phone.
Yes, I wanted to find out more on this story, naturally, because the TMZ source is scant on details. Now, this is the artwork,
inverted commas,
from Lena Marquise. She's a performance artist. And this was you've just seen the photos. This was an exhibition called Body as Commodity. It's a performance and installation. Now, let me just read you the description of this, because this is cringe-tastic.
It is.
Can I use my modern art voice?
Yes, please.
Body as a commodity forces the active audience to consider whether using a doll for sexual pleasure commodifies sex more or less immorally than using a real body for amenities that can be monetarily quantified, such as energy, the charging of a mobile phone.
Sorry, what, so you shove a battery pack up your cooch to charge a mobile phone?
This performance piece uses the exchange of literal energy for figurative energy at a monetary expense to exemplify the exchange of simulated sexuality for monetary gain.
Charging your phone from your vagina is not representing any type of weird electronic exchange.
Well, the aim of this exchange is to challenge the audience, asking them to question how the social presentation of sexuality may be affecting their seemingly inherent moral stand.
This is just art for art's sake. I mean, this is just like try to be as cringy as possible.
It's ridiculous.
Like, it is.
I went to an interview with this woman, this artist, and the interview was asking, well, you know, can you tell us more about how you did this? So you have a cable coming out of your vagina and people just hook up their phones and they're like, oh, well, we don't really want to comment on how it's done.
Like, it's a battery pack.
You're not an illusionist. You're not David Blaine. You're not David Copperfield, you know, doing some magic trick. You've got a battery inside your vagina with a cable on it. This isn't some elaborate trick. I don't like, what is there to not reveal?
Apparently her skill is that she could charge two phones at once. She actually said, we've also got a spare charger for another phone.
So the interviewer asks, going back to the way you rose to fame, because this has been really big on Twitter, and the interviewer said, do you think that's a comment on how we live our lives today?
What?
And the artist said, yes, well, actually, I think this piece actually speaks to how people are finding out about it, and how people are finding out about it is itself a commentary on the artwork. Like, what?
What the hell?
What fucking nonsense is coming out of her mouth?
I have been quite critical of Marina Abramović in the past, but you know what? I would rather sit through a Abramović, you know, presentation than this.
Is that the woman that stares
slaps
at you
people.
Until you cry?
Yeah. She slapped her partner for a while or something for 3 days or something. I would rather go. I mean, honestly, there is a photo here. I mean, it's not safe for work. There is a photo here of her full spread eagle with a cable coming out of that region.
Yeah.
Like, how is that art?
And it's just like, this is all about the existential existence of commoditization.
No, it's not.
It's so cringy and ridiculous.
Oh,
it's just completely absurd.
I've always thought, I've hoped that art is getting better. I mean, we've had the boob slap with the meat. We've had people rolling around in butter. But now here we are. We're at the point now where people are charging their phones through the vagina.
Just read, like, a link to this. Please read it, because you need to understand how backwards this is. She says the audience participant is liberated from societal ethics in order to better assess their personal moral stance on the use of a body for personal gain.
What? No.
How are you communicating that by putting a battery inside yourself with a cable coming out?
Oh, dear. All right, well, look, I'm just going to, let's move on from modern art. I wanted to mention this just before we finish up the show. Now, if you were going for a job interview, Benjamin, and you happen to want to be a bee courier, and that's exactly what it is, you want to courier bees, hives. I'm talking 80 to 100,000 angry bees.
A bee courier is a very specific job.
It's a very specific job. It's a job that's available here in Australia. You've been asked to drive a station wagon, which is carrying a trailer load of bees, 100,000 bees. When you're filling out the application form, when it says, are you allergic to anything? Do you say, oh, no, I'm fine? Or do you admit that you're allergic to bees?
Yeah.
Well, this bloke didn't. And as he's driving along, he got bitten by a bee, or stung by a bee. Oh, sorry, he got stung by a bee. And in getting stung by a bee, turns out he's allergic. He thought, no, I'll be fine. I could get past it. Loses consciousness, runs off the road. All the bees come flying out. Emergency service workers come up to try and save
him. There's bees everywhere.
There's bees. They get attacked by bees.
They had to call in emergency beekeepers to save the emergency personnel from the 80,000 angry bees.
Yeah. So this happened last Sunday night. He didn't suffer any serious injuries. And apparently the bees are now back on making honey. Yeah.
That's, a really specific job.
Well, you know what,
though?
Your job would be pretty safe when you think about it. We talk about, you know, like it being taken over by robots and technology.
Yeah.
No, you're pretty good. Although you'd want to have to be following your passion, wouldn't you, if you're allergic to bees? You're like, yeah, I'm going to work with bees.
Just loves bees. Bees totally can die at any second from a bee sting.
Maybe he's one of those people that like, you know, like fear and recklessness. Like maybe it's just like, yeah, I'm living on the edge because I could be bitten by a bee.
Like a peanut butter tester who's allergic to peanuts. Just loves it so much, so dedicated to his job.
Oh, God.
Cool story.
Yeah, absolutely.
We'll link to that in the show notes along with the Modern Art Project. Actually, she's got another project she was working on. If you go to her website and click on it, it's called fuckart.xxx. There's this new genre of art called intellectual pornography.
What the hell is intellectual pornography?
It's not looking at intellectualism as some kind of porn. It's pornography that's meant to be intellectual.
So is it like Stephen Hawking's naked in a chair?
Yeah,
or so?
Exactly.
Is that what it is? Did I get it right?
This is having sex with textbooks.
What is called self-love ritual?
Yeah.
I'm just looking. Oh no! Why am I looking at this wall? Why am I doing this?
It's the end of class. Why not?
No, I can't. That's
don't,
it. I've
done a look at it. Nah. That's for the show notes. That one. Thank you so much for being on Plus. We'll catch you on Thursday for your next MU. I think we have an interview on the cards.
Yeah, I'm lining one up. Just because of time zones, we might have a little bit of trouble. But look, we'll just wait and see. We'll play it by ear. We might have an interview. Otherwise, we're just going to have a great show anyway.
Thanks for listening. We'll see you then.